Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello.
Are we live?
We are live. Most of us are live. So a big, huge welcome to Hanoch Piven.
Thank you. Hi, Mel. How are you, my friend of, say, 17 years?
I'm very well. So like you stole my first line, which was the disclosure that we know each other. I consider myself a friend of yours, and I'm also a big fan of yours, not only because you are a world-famous artist, but because you are a mensch, you're a wonderful person. You invest most of your time in education. And rather than most people who invent something and then hide it from everybody else, you invented something global. And then you share with other people exactly how to copy what you're doing.
What? There is some truth to what you're saying.
Yeah.
But then they always tell me, we thought it was so easy. And now we see how great you are because we cannot do it the way you do it, you know.
Uh-huh.
But, so, you know, I've been doing it for 30-something years. So it's
it's altruism for fun and profit.
Exactly.
But I have to introduce the show. So I'm Mel Rosenberg, and I am the host of the Children's Literature Channel of the New Books Network. And I am here with a wonderful, spectacular guest, Hanoch Piven, who is celebrating a brand new children's book. It's not enough you're world famous, dream big and laugh often, and more great advice from the Bible, Hanoch Piven and Shira Hecht Koller.
Yes.
So this book just came out 2 months ago.
Yeah, it's really new. It came out in, of course, in United States, and it will be published in Hebrew next year by Otzat Shoken, by Shoken Books here. What do you want to know about the book?
I want to know. It's not enough that you're an iconoclastic work. Your collage artistry, your portraits have appeared in Time magazine on the cover of Newsweek and so many other important magazines. You had to mosey into children's literature too. You couldn't leave something tiny for other people. You also had to become a world famous children's writer.
Well, okay, for starters, my first book for children was published in 2001. So way before, I think, you published a book for children, right?
The point
I'm trying to make is that it's not a new thing for me. I've been doing it for I would say, you know, 7-8 years into my career, and it was a very natural progress, because in a way it's funny, because you know, I come from wanting to be a caricature artist. You can see some of my portraits behind me. There is Madonna, there is Keith Richards, there is Sarah Netanyahu, the wife of Israeli prime minister. My DNA was of a caricature artist, wanting to make faces, draw faces. But I developed into that, into the idea of using objects, everyday objects, because I cannot draw very well, as I've mentioned to you many times. And I discovered a very playful way to create. So for the first 6-7 years of my career, my work was published in serious magazines, Time, Newsweek, and Israel Haaretz. And people were telling me at the beginning, well, your work should be for children. And I was like, no way, I'm a serious artist. My work is for adults. And you know, the children will not get the subtleties of the meaning of the objects. And then they will tell me, well, it doesn't matter if a kid sees a man with a banana nose. So even if they don't know it is Woody Allen, they would laugh at the idea that there is a banana nose. So I failed to see at the beginning how much my work was really for children. So once I realized that, I embraced it. And this is, I think, my 8th or 9th or 10th book that comes out in the United States.
As far as I'm counting, it's number 8, but we might be wrong.
Okay, yeah, I mean, I had The Perfect Purple Feather and The Scary Show of Joe and Mo and Joe, and the most successful books that I had were the ones that were somewhat related to education, to the school system. What Presidents Are Made Of, a book about American presidents, was immediately taken by libraries, by school teachers, by elementary school teachers, and it became quite a successful book, which gave me for a long time royalties. And then the surprising other book, and I have to say that first book was by Ateneum, Simon Schuster, edited by Annie Kelly, who was a young editor at the time. And eventually she moved to Random House, to Schwartz and Wade Books, and she offered me to do a book together, and we came up, she really pushed it. We came up with a book called My Dog is as Smelly as Dirty Socks. And that book became really, that book is still selling very well. Why? Because the whole book is made with the idea, my dog is as smelly as, my mother is as soft as wool, as sweet as a cookie, as smart as a light bulb. And teachers in elementary school love this book because they use it to teach similes and metaphors for children in early writing. So if there is something that I learned over the years, is that a book that has some correspondence, some relevance to the school studies, is very, has a big chance to be well received and to sell well if it can serve a function.
Okay, but we're going to celebrate first of all your new book.
Okay,
open it up, show us a picture.
Yeah. So this was a way of could I share my screen? And
of course you can.
Okay,
it's your program. You can do anything.
Okay.
Lots of people are listening, so I will just say, buy this book.
Yeah, so the book really, I think it's connected in a way to what I was just talking about, education, because the book is in a way an entry point for kids to the Bible stories and the place for kids and adults and their grandparents, their parents, to start talking about the Bible. So now it is obviously relevant. It is the Old Testament. And in a way, if I describe the cover on the cover, you see Noah on the Noah ark. You see the animals, of course. And Noah's head is a mitten, and his eye is a water faucet, a water faucet, you call it?
Yeah.
So, and his mouth is an umbrella. So there are lots of connotations to water. And his beard is a scrubbing, like a metal scrubbing kitchen sponge. So it was connected with water, with cleaning. But if you look at his arms, he has the kid floaters on his arms. And for me, this is symbolic because it is a way of bringing those big names into the kids' world by making them those celebrated characters from the Bible, by putting by making them out of toys, household elements. It brings them down to, in a way, to our level, to our life. But also the idea that Noah has like a kid floaters on his arm, really, I think it's a way for the kid to relate to it.
Mm-hmm. A kid with a pair of animals, of course.
Yes. And so the way this book developed was, let me tell you something else about my work. I create collages, and you know, I know that you talk a lot about creativity, and of course there is the element of serendipity and of chance and of happy accidents that and in Yiddish it's called besher, that happen somehow and you're not expecting them. And I think when you create collages and when you're a creator in general, you are constantly looking for those happy accidents, and you increase the chances that they will come, and you are ready to see them. You are aware. You are present. You are watching. You are paying attention. You are there. So this book really happened because of a happy accident. 5 years ago, I was invited to come and give workshops in a Jewish camp in the Poconos in Pennsylvania, in a modern Orthodox camp. So, you know, I said, fine, I went there and, you know, I gave the workshops for 3 days and it, with kids that obviously everybody was religious. I wore a cap for 3 days, my jogging cap. And on the last workshop, I gave a workshop for adults, for teachers. And this woman comes to me, Shira, a scholar, and she says, I've been following you for years. I'm your fan. Let's do a book together about the Bible. And I said, ho, ho, ho. I know, since high school, I haven't done any, you know, I haven't studied anything about the Bible. But she said, I'll teach you. Let's study the Bible together. And we started to read some stories. And then I said, okay, but, you know, I don't really subscribe to the whole idea of, you know, God. I actually don't really like the way God is portrayed in the Bible. You know, he's not a very positive, depiction of him. And she said, you know, let's find what's in the Bible is relevant to you. And I said, okay, let's see how we can connect the Bible to educational stories, to stories that kids can relate to nowadays. So I asked her, okay, let's see, for example, Eve, what is the essence of the Eve story? Because, you know, traditionally we talk about the story of Eve as the story of temptation, of sin, of something negative, you know. Eve failed in the test. And she said, well, you know what? You could also say that the story of Eve is the story of curiosity, of wanting to know. And I said, you know what? This kind of really was the key that opened the door for me to enter into these stories and to say, well, the Jewish people have been doing parshanut, have been doing their own interpretation of those stories forever. Why can't I do it? Why can't Shira and I do it as well, you know, and find there, distill the values that are relevant to us. And through us, they might be relevant to other people as well. So it became eventually a story of advice. If the kid were to meet those Bible characters, what advice would they give them? So Eve might tell you to be curious, and Noah might tell you, my advice to kid, to be good, be a good person, behave in a good way. And Abraham, which is a favorite of mine because of his advice, is trust the journey. It's sort of a Dr. Seuss quote. If you go places, you'll discover new things. But Abraham was told to go on a journey without a clear destiny. And he walked and walked and walked throughout the whole of the Middle East and more. And eventually, after making big, many, many, many rounds, he arrived to the promised land. So I, as a creator, I can identify very much to this story of going on a journey and trusting it, not knowing where it will take you, and trusting it.
So, Chanoch, I wanted to ask you here in this picture. Yeah. The people who are listening are just going to have to go out and buy the book. I'm repeating, it's called Dream Big, Laugh Often. And it's out and available everywhere in the Western world, especially in the Bible Belt. No, I'm joking. And here you have like a picture of the globe made out of jigsaw piece puzzles.
Right. It's Abraham. It's Abraham, and he is going to a place that is still doesn't have shape. So it's made out of jigsaw puzzle. Mm-hmm.
And his body is a collector's item. It's
an envelope. It's a letter.
Yeah,
postcard. Envelope. Yeah, with. Yeah, and in a way, and he's carrying a suitcase, mm-hmm, with traveler's stickers, you know, like, yeah. I've been to London, I've been to Paris, and
I've been to Ur Kasdim.
Yeah, to Ur Kasdim, exactly. And there is a camel carrying a container. So there is nonsense in my work. I use the nonsense for the kids to laugh, to discover, to say, well, this doesn't make sense that he will be carrying a suitcase with stickers of Paris, you know, and that the camel will be carrying a container from a toy truck. But also his nose is a dreidel with a hey, the Hebrew letter hey, which was the letter that was added to the name Abraham. It's a letter that represents God in Hebrew. So this is also an entry point to the story. This is something that there is nonsense, but there is a place that the teacher and the kid, or the grandparent, or the parent and the kid can look together. And then the parent can tell the story of the hay that was added to Abraham's name.
So Chanoch, this book is like a jigsaw puzzle in its own right. You can look at it and look for clues and what you were meaning to do when you added all of these bric-a-bracs and little toys and
Looking at Sarah. So there are two sides to the book that can have independent lives. I mean, one, Shira and I came up with those values, those advices, and we wrote the text together with help of a wonderful writer, Naomi Schulman. Mm-hmm. But the illustrations are my own crazy world in which, you know, for example, we're looking at Sarah, Abraham's wife, and she's laughing. And actually, her advice is, you know, it's okay to laugh and to giggle when you don't know what to answer, which is what she did when three angels, three visitors told her she was going to be a mom at 85 or however old she was. You know, I had fun putting chattering teeth as her eyes and you know, making the and the three angels, the three visitors, one is a robot, the other one is a waiter, and the other one is, God knows what he is, you know, the yellow green one on the right.
So for teachers teaching this in class, do you have like a handbook of Chanoch's icons here? And
no, but I would say, okay, for starters, the book is given out by PJ Library in United States. It has been handed out this month to, I think, fourth graders. I think they handed out like 60,000 books. So the PJ Library version definitely comes with an educational guide. I have to say that over the years, I learned so much from teachers that taught me how to use my work educationally, because they send me the projects that they do. And I'll show you, I can show you some soon.
Okay. Chanoch, this show is also about you and your journey.
Yes.
So I'm going to ask you to stop sharing the screen for a minute, and everybody is going to run out and buy your book. If you show everybody the book, they're not going to buy it. So I want to get back to the book, but I want to start out with you, because in these interviews, we also look at the journey of the illustrators, authors, the people who actually create this. And but before I do, so you are a creator here. Are you playing God? You know, you're giving these biblical characters faces and personalities. And the word create in English is something that humans do and also God does. Not in Hebrew.
Right.
So you're also teaching kids that it's okay to create their own Bible figures.
Well, it's okay. You know, I like to say, and this became very, very clear during COVID, but I like to say in general to kids, what happened is that during COVID, we were all kids. Kids don't have control over what happens in the big world. Adults, we also don't have control, but we think that we have, you know. Kids don't have control. They feel lost. Everything, they're small. Everybody else is big. They feel powerless. Everybody else has much more power. But when they're creating art, in their little letter size page or whatever, however big their space in which they create is, I'm holding a cardboard. They are God. They have all the power in the world to dream, to behave in a different way, to be mean, to fail also, to not to be good kids, not to be successful, not to do what they're expected to do, to draw guns, to shoot, to kill. You know, I think it's okay to do it within the art space. This is what art is made for. Art is a place, is a space that is protected. It's not the real world. So I love that. And I think that for me, it also allowed me, when I was doing caricatures and I was drawing mean pictures of people, I would meet people on the street that they didn't know me, and they would meet me and they said, but you're so nice. I imagine you as being a big, nasty man, you know. But that is exactly the place where when you create, you can be somebody else. Mm-hmm. And I really like that aspect. And if this is somehow related to be godlike, I don't know, but it is definitely talks about the omnipotent power that you have when you create, okay, within your creation.
Okay, that's good. We'll come back to that. Now take us back to Chanoch, the little boy, because you have argued that you're a little boy at heart, and I'm not going to argue with you, and I also know you. Take us back to that child and your studies and how you discovered this language of yours. I'm going to call it a language.
Yeah, I missed what you said about the little kid, but you said a word that I couldn't hear very well. You said that the little kid was whatever.
Chanoch the little kid. What were you like? Okay. And why are you stuck, like many creative people, back in your childhood?
I don't know if I'm stuck in my childhood, but I almost feel like the same person. Obviously I am the same person, but I have feelings that I say, well, those are exactly the same feelings that I had when I was a kid, you know, and some obviously not, but I think I was an observer. I was the little kid in the family. I was physically little, short, always the shortest kid in the class. So I feel that in a way, my drawings, my funny drawings, but also something about my behavior was calling for attention, was calling, you know, to be noticed. I always identify with, in the final scene of Shrek 1, there is the donkey jumping behind. He wants to be seen, you know? So I think that when you're short, you're jumping constantly because you want to be seen. So there was that aspect, I feel. Metaphorically, of course, I wasn't jumping all the time. And I guess there is some drawing capacities in my family. Not amazing, but... you know, we were all good in drawings. I was drawing in Uruguay cows, football, soccer players. And then when I was born in Uruguay, when we moved to Israel in the 70s, I was drawing fighter airplanes and guns and soldiers and some soccer players still.
How old were you when you came, Chanoch?
I was 11 and we settled in Ramat Gan, and I went to a very middle, very proper school, which you might have heard of, Blich Ramat Gan, which is a very, it's a school that, you know, you need to be a good boy and, you know, at that time, also in the 70s, Israel was a very homogeneous society, so I needed to fit in. So I think that anything that was a little bit different, like drawing, you know, I sort of put it aside. I studied math. I ended up with high school degree, diploma with high grades in math and in computer science. I served in the army for 5 years. And then after I finished the army, I actually applied automatically because I had good grades to medical school and to computer science. And I was accepted to both. And a week before medical school started, I said, you know, why am I doing this? That's not what I want to do. So I'm just doing it because, you know, I have good grades and I want to fit in and I want to do what I'm expected to do because I'm a good boy.
Where were you accepted to study medicine?
In Jerusalem in 1987.
Because had you been accepted, 1986. Had you been accepted in Tel Aviv, I would have been your teacher, you see.
Oh, okay. Whoa.
But at the last minute, you said, This is not the Chanoch Piven I know.
Well, I mean, I kind of, you know, I wasn't that smart. I only somehow I was intuitive. I listened to my intuition enough to say, this is not right for me. And maybe only then, at the age of 22, or 23, I was strong enough as a new immigrant. You know, I was already strong enough to listen to my own gut. And then I studied for 1 year computer science in Jerusalem. We have some common friends that studied at that time with me. I didn't know them then, but, you know, which became very prominent in the high-tech industry in Israel. But after 1 year there, I said, you know, obviously this is not for me. I'm bored. And during that year, I said, I really want to go back to my love of drawing, my love of illustrating caricatures. There was the Eichmann, the other Nazi, the Maniuk trial that year. They caught the Nazi, Ivan the Maniuk, Ivan the Great, Ivan the Terrible, and there was a trial that was being was open for the public in Jerusalem. And I remember I went to listen to the trial, and it was a sold out. I couldn't get in. But next door to where the trial was happening was the Israeli Museum. So I went to the museum instead. And thank God there was a sold out. And there was an exhibition by an Israeli artist that I did not know then, called Dudu Gershon. He was just starting for the first time to do his three-dimensional sculptures. And the way that Dudu was talking, the way he was really talking about art in a very inclusive way, it wasn't about, I am an artist and you're not. I know and you don't. I am touched by God and you're not. Which, you know, is what I thought, what I've heard before, because I did take classes in art, and there was always what I felt, you know, if you don't have something important to say about the world, don't be an artist, you know, all this threatening, all this ideas that make you feel small, because, you know, you don't immediately find what you have to say about the world. You start working and slowly you discover things. And Dudu was talking about playfulness. He was approachable. I mean, I just saw a video with him. And then I went back to my apartment and I found out in the phone book his address. And I wrote him a little postcard, a gluyak. And I said, I saw your show. I am studying computer science, but I want to be an illustrator like you. Could I come and meet you? And he called me the next day to my apartment. There weren't cell phones then. And he said, come over to the studio. And I went to the studio, and he really showed me his work, and we talked a lot, and he gave me advice. And I have to say, and you know, and I've met Dudu many times since, and he really opened the door for me in a very deep way. So after that, I couldn't turn back. I just quit. I dropped out of college, you could say, and I applied to Bezalel, to the big art school in Israel. And I was not accepted. I was rejected. I was told, you know, well, you don't draw enough. I don't know what I was told. It was very difficult to be accepted to the graphic design department, which was the only place you could study illustration in Israel back then. So I was rejected, and but I was already, my mind was set. So I said, I'm going away. And I had a friend that was studying dance in Juilliard in New York. And I went to stay with him, and I applied to schools in New York. I was accepted to the School of Visual Arts. I got a job first as a mover, then as a waiter, and then the best job.
You were a mover?
I was a mover, yeah. I was for half a year, I moved furniture in New York and drove a truck. And then I got the best possible job. I got a security job at one of the Israeli government delegations in Manhattan. But my security job was so that I could not guard people. I could only guard an empty space. That meant that when everybody went home, I came to the office and I locked myself in and I spent the night there with the computers, the Xerox machines, and nobody could get in. So it was the perfect job to do my art school projects. And I had that job for 4 years throughout my studies at the School of Visual Arts in New York. And I know I still have not answered the question how I started to create with objects. I'm getting to it now.
No, take your time. This is a lot of fun. I'm going to just now intervene because there must have been some stage when you told your family, who was so happy that you got into medical school, you said, no, I'm going to study computers. And they said, oh, well, studying computers is also what they say in Yiddish, nicht gefährlich. Not so bad.
You'll be okay.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden you become a furniture mover in New York and you've lost direction. What did the family say?
Yeah, I have to thank my parents. They were kind of a bit confused and lost with what I was doing. But, I do have a very supportive family. And I guess also at that point, they trusted me somehow. It's a family of immigrants and... They were happy to be here. I love my parents and I'm very grateful of what they did. They always were supportive. But of course, I had my own pressure being in my 20s. And, I had my own set of high expectations because I met lots of successful people around me that obviously it put pressure on me as well.
You wanted to jump up and down like the donkey in Shrek.
Yeah, and I was determined. I think I came to Israel at the age 11 and I left Israel at the age of 24. And I came back here 10 years later. So from 11 to 24, I lived here in Israel, and I think Israel gave me a lot of chutzpah, a lot of somehow I came out of the army feeling more confident, and so when I went to New York, I had the Israeli chutzpah combined. Then I realized with some very strong South American side that was more maybe lyrical, playful. So I started the art school. I started drawing illustrations, and lo and behold, I discovered that I suck. I'm not very good. that all these years that I was doing other stuff, I did not train my hand. I had a long way to go. Next to me were kids that were younger than me, but they were masterful with a pencil and masterful with a pen and ink. And all around, I saw people that were much better than me technically. They didn't have necessarily a better sense of humor. Maybe they were not, maybe I had some better ideas, but when it came to execution, I was really not very good. I had a better eye and a better head than my hand. My hand was an obstacle in a way, I could say. And so I, because there was all this pressure to succeed or to be able to make a living, I said, okay, I'll move out of the illustration and cartooning department to the graphic design department. That's a job. I'll have a studio and everybody I'll be able to make some kind of a living. And doing that really liberated me from the pressure, the technical pressure. And I started to, even though I was studying graphic design, typography, composition, I was studying other things that really opened my mind. And I always recommend when I meet art school or anybody, but when I go to an art school, I always recommend kids to take as many different classes as possible in different areas. Photography can teach you a lot. Typography can teach you a lot. I took a class in playwriting. I took a class in, in American history in the 60s, sort of what you teach. And there somehow I came to discover Eastern European collages, Eastern European posters, and all those Romanians and Polish that were very surrealistic in their creations. And they, the most famous one, of course, is Saul Steinberg. That was a Romanian-born artist that after some years in Paris, came to America. And he's sort of the grandparent, the founding father of a modern American illustration. Everybody knows his New Yorker covers, the New York map, the famous New York map that he made. I started to take caricature classes again, just as a minor for the fun. And there, one time I was drawing Saddam Hussein and I, during the first Gulf War, and I didn't know how to make his mustache. And I saw a box of matches and I said, okay, I'll use the matches.
No, Is this true? I've heard you say this. On several occasions. Yeah. This is a true story.
You know what? I don't remember.
Who cares?
No. I mean, who cares? I mean, it's a great story. I mean, obviously those matches were somehow next to my illustration because I saw them. And I was living then with a girlfriend that was a heavy smoker, so there were matches all around us. That was one segment of it. The other factor was I saw this poster for the movie The Great Dictator, which was a very minimalistic poster in which there were no eyes, no features in the face. But you could still tell this is Charlie Chaplin and Adolf Hitler, or Charlie Chaplin portraying an Adolf Hitler-like dictator. So all this came together, the idea that sometimes you don't have to show all the features in order to make somebody recognizable. Sometimes you don't have to draw if you find a way to communicate. And this was a light bulb that really opened up, because I realized that I could hide the idea that I don't draw very well. Because now, why is this? So I realized that, that I can draw by moving objects around the space. Because when you move two objects, you create shapes. You create the shape that the two of them make. You create the shape that is around them. You create the shape that is between them. The negative shape is a shape also. So you are drawing. It's just a different definition of drawing. Drawing is not necessarily making a line. Drawing is creating shapes, defining shapes. So this connects to what we were talking before about kids that, suddenly this system that was developed by me to overcome my own, for lack of a better word, shortcomings, was really a tool that eliminated the technique barrier. So in a way, in the same way that I eliminated for myself, I realized that I could eliminate it. I could take it away for other people too. And then everybody with toys, with objects in collage could have the experience of creating art, the experience of telling something. Because the purpose of, in my book, the purpose of creating art is really to tell a story, to tell something.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so this is now several decades. You're also one of the pioneers of using a, I would say, like a early kind of artificial intelligence to develop apps where people can actually try and be Chanuch Piven. I've tried to be Chanuch Piven. I've taken your classes.
Faces I make. Yeah.
Yeah, and I made a self portrait, and it was amazing. Somewhere, it was amazingly terrible. So it's got all the elements, you know. It's got Mel the musician and so on, but it doesn't have the composition. So actually, you're doing something safe because you can teach the whole world to be Chanuch Piven, but the only person who's going to be Chanuch Piven is you. So now I just figured out your secret. It's a great idea, right? You tell everybody, come on and be Chanuch Piven, but you know that nobody's ever going to be you. That's great.
Yeah, well, it's partly true, I would say, but I would say that I this is something that I tell always, the idea that basically this is when I conduct a workshop, I say immediately, this is not mainly an art workshop. This is a communication workshop. Art is only the means that we will use to communicate. To communicate in two ways, to communicate one with the other. We will be creating next to another one. Maybe we'll creating together. Maybe we will be showing each other our creations. But more important than that, to communicate inwards. Each person will communicate inwards. When you're making something, you are in an inner dialogue. And most people will not do, if you bring them a pen, a brush, a pencil, and you tell them draw, they will immediately go to their last failed experience, which is in when they were 8, 9, 7, when they drew a person and the leg came out of the head and they realized that they don't know how to draw. They decided that they don't know how to draw and they stopped drawing. And the idea of drawing or of creating art for most people is connected with a primal experience of failure. So once they do something with objects and they immediately see that something happens and they see it, then they have a sense of success. Even if they just create a happy face and then they make it sad. But then when you add the idea that objects have meaning, that you can tell something about yourself by representing your mouth with candy or representing it with sour lemon or representing it with nails or representing it with a ruler, whatever. Once you finish your creation and there is Mel the musician and there is Mel the teacher and there is Mel connected with smells. And your creation, and again, I don't know your experience, you know, I don't want to undermine your own experience, but for the most part, people feel happy with what they created.
I was delighted by the process, by the fun.
And, Right, the fun, but also they feel happy, content and satisfied. And I ask them in a funny way, I ask them, are you happy with your creation? Yeah. And I said, do you think your creation, are you happy because your creation could be hanged tomorrow at the Louvre, at the Museum of Modern Art? And I said, no. I mean, they always say, yes, of course. But, you know, but they said, no. So why are you happy with it? Because I made it, because it represents me. But what it means really in a deeper way, they're happy because it has meaning to them. They manage to distill something that is meaningful to them and represent it. And then other people saw it and other people saw them. And going back to being kids, what do we want most of all? We want to be seen. We want to be noticed. We want to be acknowledged. And when somebody makes a picture and he shows it, she shows it, and other people say, great. And other people, maybe they might recognize, oh, you put the nose because this. So people are seen. So I think this is the reason why I am in education, why I'm teaching, obviously it is, it is a way of bringing food to the table of my family, but I cannot even start telling you how happy this road makes me. I don't feel like it's work necessarily. Because
why should it be work if you love it so much?
Yeah. I basically help people tell their story and feel happy about it and play. And, you know, for some people, this will be the only time they do it. For some other people, they will come back to me later and say, you know, you opened my eye to something. Other people will say, you know, since your workshop, I've been doing it more. You know, it's a very satisfying experience.
I'm a bad example, and I'll tell you why. I'm a bad example because I get to know the real thing, which is you. So, I've been in your classes. I've made all kinds of things. I've used the toothpaste for my mouth, and there's some musical notes for my nose. And I've learned your language, but because I'm also lucky that Yossi Vardi introduced us and I actually get to know Chanuch Piven, the creator. You're much bigger than your art, and your art is universal. And you're one of the people that I've met who's created a language. You know, it appears simple. You know, you take a portrait and then you mix it together with the things that make up the, you know, the background of the character, and you create an artwork. So in the meantime, you're teaching everybody to speak the language, but man, you invented the language. And you're a real mensch, and we have to go. I'm going to interview you more, and you've given me a great idea, but I'm going to take it off camera because I don't want to share it. And for all the Jewish people watching us, we have to go because we have Shavuot.
We have right.
Holiday. We have to go eat cheese. So Chanuch, show everybody your wonderful book.
Yeah, and the reason I love Shavuot is because the story of Ruth, which is a story, and we will say goodbye with Ruth, I guess, because
Ruth Avor.
Yeah, because the story of Ruth is a story of choosing your family, of choosing who you want to be around, of having the freedom to follow your heart, and I love that story as well. So thank you, Mel, for being so generous and always.
Thank you, Chanuch. I'm really, you're a gem of a human being. I'm delighted to know you. Keep up this amazing, marvelous work of yours. And I'm going to share my idea off screen. So we have to sum up. There's a holiday here. Got to go. They're knocking at my door. But we're going to continue. Write another book. We'll do another interview. Or we'll just do another interview. My name is Mel Rosenberg, before I forget, and I am the host of the Children's Literature Channel. for the New Books Network, and I've been speaking to the miraculous, wonderful Chanoch Piven, who has created a universe of his own, and he is the author, illustrator, and co-author of the new book, Dream Often, Dream Big, Laugh Often, and co-written with Shira Hecht-Koller. And yes. Chanoch, bless you, my friend. It's been great.
Bye-bye, and happy holiday.
Chag Sameach. Take care, my friend. Chag Sameach. Bye.